the leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement, slammed some Arab states' decision to normalize ties with Tel Aviv, saying such moves will never undermine Palestinians' resistance. EU foreign ministers say the bloc is drafting proposals for an oil embargo on Russia, adding there is still no agreement on banning Russian crude. The White House says it expects, quote, extraordinarily elevated inflation figures for March amid spiking energy prices caused by the war in Ukraine and Western bans on Russia. Good to have you with us. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has hailed the heroic acts of Palestinian youths in their fight against the Israeli regime. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said Israel's atrocities will only make Palestinians more determined in their resistance against the regime. The Hezbollah leader said the ongoing developments in Palestine will have a great impact on the struggle against Israel and the regime's future outlook. Nasrallah slammed some Arab states' decision to normalize ties with Tel Aviv. He said those who believe such moves would undermine Palestinians' resistance are deluded. He pointed to the U.S. support for Israel, saying Washington always defends aggressors and those who start wars.
We see that the United States of America continues to defend and protect the enemy that commits massacres, that launches wars, that occupies other people's lands, and even prohibits denouncing such an enemy and leave aside the fact that they prohibit and veto any resolution that would punish the Israelis, but also all the continuous wars on Palestinians and Lebanese and the people of the region and how they are dealing today also with the Russian-Ukrainian war.
Nasrallah also touched upon next month's parliamentary elections in Lebanon, saying surveys show that Hezbollah and its allies will win the vote. He says certain parties are misleading the Lebanese people by telling them that resistance weapons are the cause of their problems. Nasrallah said such moves are aimed at appeasing the U.S. and the West and some Arab regimes in order to win their financial support. He said Hezbollah intends to be present in the government to prevent anyone from using the state to target the resistance or stab it in the back. The Hezbollah chief further warned against efforts made to delay the polls, accusing the U.S. Embassy in Beirut of trying to impede the electoral process. Nasrallah also called for a massive turnout in the international Quds Day rallies across the Muslim world on the last Friday of the fasting month of Ramadan as a sign of solidarity with Palestinians. At least one person is killed and seven others wounded in a blast hitting a building in the southern Lebanese port city of Sidon. A security source said the explosion took place near a bureau affiliated with the Lebanese Amal movement in the city, adding that it was an act of sabotage. The source didn't give further details on the incident. The blast demolished the building and damaged the nearby town hall. Army personnel were searching through the rubble for further casualties. Or rubble, I should say. There was no immediate word on the cause of the blast. No group has so far claimed responsibility for the incident. Israeli forces have killed four Palestinians, including two women, in different incidents in the occupied West Bank in less than 24 hours, as tensions are on the rise across the territory over the Israeli aggression. Our correspondent Mona Kandil reports from Ramallah.
Tensions have been running high in the occupied Palestinian territories, mainly in the northern West Bank city of Jenin in the last few days. Israeli forces have shot dead several Palestinians in separate incidents, including two women in less than 24 hours. On Monday, 17-year-old Palestinian teenager Mohammed Zakarni succumbed to injuries he sustained during an Israeli military raid in Jenin. This came as Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has granted all military and security forces full freedom of operation. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs considered Bennett's statement as an order to kill Palestinians.
It's an order to kill. It's a war crime, actually, and a crime against humanity of the Palestinian people. Israel is trying now to escalate the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory to consolidate its apartheid and colonial regime in the occupied Palestinian territory using all the illegal measures, including the extrajudicial killing.
As Israeli forces continue raiding Jenin and the surrounding towns, Palestinian resistance groups in the city announced a state of alert and called for general mobilization of their activists to confront the Israeli military incursion. Protests have also been held across the occupied West Bank in solidarity with Jenin and its residents. Moreover, the Israeli military forces have maintained their presence across the occupied West Bank. Experts warn that they will also escalate a crackdown against Palestinians and use even more excessive force to fight the Palestinian resistance.
We are facing an escalation of events. The smell of a new intifada rises. Numerous funerals for Palestinians in several areas due to clashes taking place in friction points and sites. One can tell an escalation is expected on all fronts, which might then lead to the return of calm.
Tel Aviv has been stunned by a string of deadly operations in the last weeks. 14 Israelis, including soldiers, have been killed. Since then, tensions have risen sharply. The Israeli army has stepped up its daily raids and arrests in an attempt to crack down on the spiraling violence.
It's obvious that Tel Aviv is heading toward another heavy-handed crackdown against Palestinians in the occupied territories and specifically in Jenin. But Palestinians who have been confronting military raids warn such crimes and escalation could at the end of the day set off a new intifada or popular uprising against the regime. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Tehran has warned against plots to incite negative sentiments toward Iran and Afghanistan between the people of the two countries. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said certain elements are seeking to foment Iranophobia and Afghanphobia through certain remarks and video clips. Said Khatibzadeh said despite such efforts, the two nations enjoy profound historical relations. It was reacting to videos posted on social media showing extremist mobs attacking the Iranian embassy in Kabul and its consulate in the eastern city of Herat. Khatibzadeh said Afghanistan's acting Taliban government is responsible for protecting foreign diplomatic missions. The spokesman said the foreign ministry is in contact with Iran's ambassador and officials of diplomatic missions in other Afghan cities to investigate the incident. The war between Russia and Ukraine is nearing its seventh week. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says his country will not halt its military operation during the next round of peace talks. Lavrov says Russia suspended military action during the first round of talks. He says Moscow will no longer pause its operation as it's convinced that Ukrainian forces will not follow suit. Meantime, Moscow says it has destroyed S-300 air defense systems supplied to Ukraine by an unidentified European country. The statement comes as Ukraine says it's bracing for a major Russian military offensive in its eastern Donbass region. The revelation has also been confirmed by the head of the self-proclaimed Donetsk Republic, who pledged to intensify operations to liberate the region. Moscow says the United States and Britain are helping Ukraine prepare fake claims about the alleged persecution of civilians in Ukraine in an attempt to smear Russia. Russia's defense ministry said the Ukrainian government was being directed by the two Western powers to show false evidence of Russian violence against civilians. The ministry says the U.S. has years of experience of organizing provocations under false pretexts. The ministry says the efforts come despite Moscow's unprecedented measures to save civilians. In recent weeks, Ukrainian troops have been showing journalists corpses of what they claim are civilians killed by Russian forces before retreating from towns and villages around the capital, Kyiv. The West says the dead civilians are evidence of war crimes. Ukraine says Russia is guilty of genocide, an allegation Moscow has rejected vehemently. The European Union is said to be working on draft proposals that could potentially target Russia's oil sector in response to its military offensive in Ukraine. The foreign ministers of Ireland, Lithuania, and the Netherlands revealed that a process is underway, but said there is still no agreement to ban Russian crude. Ahead of a ministerial meeting in Luxembourg, they said a 27-member bloc is looking at ways for an oil embargo. The European Parliament last week voted for such measure, although its decision was not binding. The bloc that relies on a quarter of oil imports from Russia has come up with a wave of sanctions targeting hundreds of Russian people and entities since a war was launched on Ukraine. In response, Moscow has also announced retaliatory measures against European countries. Boris Johnson landed in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, over the weekend on a surprise visit where he pledged additional British military hardware to the tune of tens of millions of pounds, as well as ramping up the anti-Russian rhetoric. British observers are now asking whether this move by Johnson will do anything other than prolonging the conflict. Amina Taylor has more from the British capital, London.
Britain has made its pro-Ukraine stance clear, with the flag of Kiev fluttering atop several government buildings in Whitehall. Yet it was still a surprise when UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson popped up alongside Vladimir Zelensky for a walkabout in the near-deserted streets of the Ukrainian capital. The mutual political backslapping seems at odds with the reality of the crisis, but Johnson pledged further military support, including 120 armored vehicles and anti-ship missile systems.
Together with our partners, we are going to ratchet up the economic pressure, and we will continue to intensify, week by week, the sanctions on Russia. Not just freezing assets in banks and sanctioning oligarchs, but moving away from use of Russian hydrocarbons.
Back in London, the optics were not as glossy.
Well, I think Boris Johnson is engaging in a propaganda exercise designed to manufacture consent for prolonging a war, which a proxy war, that is, which is unwinnable. And rather than indulging in this sort of publicity exercise, he ought to be focusing, in my opinion, on diplomacy to bring the war to an end.
Boris Johnson has pledged further support to Kiev in the shape of military hardware and by ramping up the anti-Russian action. It's also been mentioned that the Prime Minister might have taken this crisis as an opportunity to bolster his conflict credentials. But what of the voices urging a de-escalation and not adding fuel to this international fire? Well, many argue they won't be found here in the corridors of British power. Britain's role in the conflict, especially its supply of more armaments, has not brought the result it perhaps hoped.
Well, it doesn't help the people of Ukraine, and nor does it help the people in this country or indeed across Europe. The strategy which is being pursued by NATO is entirely counterproductive. I mean, they're heading potentially towards a wider conflagration, maybe a third world war.
At the heart of this conflict is a wider issue, one Zelensky reminded Johnson.
If we were in NATO, this war wouldn't have happened. Or it would have unfolded differently. You would have the shoulder of close neighbours, strong neighbours, or we could all fight together. And probably war would not happen.
Until real diplomacy prevails with Moscow and Kiev thrashing out their regional affairs, publicity tours like the ones undertaken by Britain's Prime Minister will only do so much. Amina Taylor, London.
In France, final results of the first round of the presidential election show incumbent Emmanuel Macron and his far-right contender Marine Le Pen would face a runoff on April the 24th. Macron won more than 27% of the votes, while Le Pen came second with over 23%. The results show a repeat of the 2017 runoff between the same candidates. However, this year, the gap between the two has become much closer. Opinion polls forecast a victory for Macron with 55% of the votes. Macron and Le Pen have campaigned on sharply opposing agenda. Le Pen has pledged radical domestic and international changes for the country, but Macron criticizes her approach as the one aligned with populists and xenophobes. He called the upcoming 2 weeks a decisive period for the future of France and Europe.
The first round of the French presidential election is finished, and as expected, there will be a repeat of 2017. Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen will duel once again in the second round of voting.
Maybe the French people will surprise everyone and elect Marine Le Pen. This is her second time making it to the second round, and maybe people will give her a chance. But I think Macron will win because too many people are either scared to vote for Le Pen or feel they will be disappointed by her.
I think Macron is brilliant and that he has handled the coronavirus crisis very well. Le Pen is too racist and too extreme right.
Macron's team brushed off recent polls that actually have Le Pen winning in the second round, as she has soared in the last month to make the race a dead heat.
Now everything begins. We need to explain the project we had for the five coming years with the president, because the president was not in a position to completely explain his project. He was at work for the French people because of the Ukrainian crisis.
In a close third place, just 1% behind Le Pen, was Jean-Luc Mélenchon, a former Socialist Party minister who turned left. In a bid to win over centrists, he didn't embrace the yellow vests, and barring a huge cache of votes somewhere, he's headed home and perhaps has aged out of politics. In fourth place, with a disappointing 7%, was mainstream media pundit Eric Zemmour, who was seemingly given control of the campaign agenda for months, despite setting new lows in Islamophobia and racism. The mainstream conservative candidate, Valérie Pécresse, was a distant fifth. The so-called Sarkozyist candidate didn't even get the endorsement of former President Nicolas Sarkozy. The once mighty Socialist Party might be finished after garnering less than 2%, and only the two communist candidates scored less. Finishing a surprising seventh was Jean Lassalle, the only MP to wear a yellow vest in French Parliament. Parliament immediately suspended itself, and Lassalle was fined.
Is Le Pen still so shocking after 5 years of Macronism and in a post-Donald Trump world? Has Macron provided enough stability in a post-coronavirus landscape? We'll have the verdict of France's voters on April 24th. Roman Mazahari, Paris.
The White House has warned that the already high U.S. inflation rate climbed even further last month amid spiking energy prices. The White House press secretary said the U.S. administration expects, quote, extraordinarily elevated headline inflation figures for March ahead of a consumer price index report, which is due to be released Tuesday. Jen Psaki blamed Russia's war on Ukraine along with retaliatory Western sanctions on Moscow for skyrocketing costs of energy, including gasoline. However, even before the start of the Ukraine war, prices were rising in the U.S. at record rates as it recovered from the COVID-19 pandemic. The CPI rose nearly 8% over 12 months to February, registering its fastest rate in four decades. The price hikes were blamed on a number of factors, including component and labor shortages, shipping delays, and strong consumer demand.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Former U.S. President Donald Trump's legal jeopardy about the 6th of January insurrection is growing, but experts say Attorney General Merrick Garland must move carefully. We now present you an article written by Peter Stone. The piece is titled, Is Trump in His Sights? Garland Under Pressure to Charge Ex-President. The U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland is facing more political pressure to move faster and expand the U.S. Department of Justice's investigation into the January 6th Capitol attack and charge Donald Trump and some of his former top aides. With mounting evidence from the January 6th House panel, court rulings and news reports that Donald Trump engaged in a criminal conspiracy in his aggressive drive to thwart Joe Biden's election win in 2020, Merrick Garland and his staff face an almost unique decision, whether to charge a former U.S. president. However, former Justice Department officials caution that while there's growing evidence of criminal conduct by Donald Trump to obstruct Congress from certifying Joe Biden's win on 6th of January 2021 and defraud the government, building a strong case to prove Trump's corrupt intent, a necessary element to convict him, probably requires more evidence and more time. In an important speech in January of this year, Merrick Garland said he would hold all January 6th perpetrators at any level accountable, if they were present at the Capitol that day or not, who were responsible for this assault on our democracy, which suggested to some ex-prosecutors that Donald Trump and some of his allies were in his sights. But rising pressures on Merrick Garland to move faster with a clearer focus on Donald Trump and his top allies have come from Democrats on the House panel investigating the Capitol attack. Those concerns were underscored recently when the House sent a criminal referral to the Justice Department charging contempt of Congress by two Trump aides, trade advisor Peter Navarro and communications chief Dan Scavino, who refused to cooperate after being subpoenaed. Panel member Adam Schiff said, "We are upholding our responsibility. The Department of Justice must do the same." Likewise, Congresswoman Elaine Luria urged Merrick Garland to do your job so we can do ours. About 4 months ago, the House sent a criminal contempt of Congress referral to the Justice Department for the former White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, but so far he has not been indicted. However, some former top Department of Justice officials and prosecutors claim that Merrick Garland is moving correctly and expeditiously in pursuing all criminal conduct to overturn Biden's election in its sprawling January 6th inquiry. The former Justice Inspector General Michael Bromwich told The Guardian, "When people, including many lawyers, criticize the Department of Justice for not more clearly centering the January 6th investigation on Donald Trump, they are expressing impatience rather than a clear understanding of the trajectory of the investigation." He added, "Department of Justice is methodically building the case from the bottom up. It is almost surely the most complex criminal investigation in the nation's history, involving the most prosecutors, the most investigators, the most digital evidence, and the most defendants." Bromwich added that people view the scores of ongoing criminal prosecutions of participants in the January 6th insurrection as somehow separate from the investigation of Donald Trump. They are not. He is the subject of the investigation at the top of the pyramid. People need to carefully watch what is happening, not react based on their impatience. The department's investigation is the biggest one ever. More than 750 people have been charged so far with federal crimes, and about 250 individuals have pleaded guilty. still concerns about the pace of the investigation and why charges have not been filed against Donald Trump have been spurred in part by a few revelations over the last couple of months. Last month, for instance, federal judge David Carter, in a crucial court ruling involving a central Trump legal adviser, John Eastman, stated that Trump, more likely than not, broke the law in his weeks-long drive to stop Joe Biden from taking office. Judge David Carter wrote in a civil case which resulted in an order for John Eastman to release more than 100 emails he had withheld from the House panel, "Dr. Eastman and President Trump launched a campaign to overturn a Democratic election, an action unprecedented in American history." Similarly, the 6th of January Select Committee made a 61-page court filing on 2nd of March this year that implicated Trump in a criminal conspiracy to block Congress from certifying Joe Biden's win. On another legal front that could implicate Trump and some of his top allies, the Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco revealed in January that the Department of Justice was starting a criminal investigation into a sprawling scheme, reportedly spearheaded by Trump's ex-lawyer Rudy Giuliani and Trump campaign aides, to replace legitimate electors for Joe Biden with false ones pledged to Trump in 7 states that Biden won. Further, the Washington Post reported recently that the Department of Justice had begun looking into the funding and organizing of the January 6th Save America rally in Washington involving some Trump allies. Donald Trump repeated his false claims at the rally that the election was stolen. Trump falsely told the cheering crowd, "We won this election and we won it by a landslide." He said, "You don't concede when there is theft involved," urging the large crowd to fight like hell shortly before the Capitol attack by hundreds of his supporters that led to 140 injured police officers and several deaths. Meanwhile, a Trump spokesperson, Taylor Budowich, has called the House January 6th inquiry a circus of partisanship. And Taylor Budowich attacked Judge David Carter's ruling as absurd and baseless, noting that Judge Carter was a Clinton-appointed judge in California. Dennis Aftergut, a former federal prosecutor, told The Guardian that recent actions by the House January 6th panel and by the Department of Justice, along with court opinions, have notably increased legal threats to Donald Trump. He said, "Anyone would need ice in their veins not to feel the heat when all three branches of the federal government are breathing down your neck." On the issue of whether Donald Trump may be indicted, Donald Eyre, who served as Deputy Attorney General in the George H.W. Bush administration, said, "The critical question should be whether there is adequate proof of wrongdoing intent." Citing Judge Carter's ruling that Trump more likely than not broke the law, Donald Eyre said that the evidence of such intent has recently become a lot stronger. Nonetheless, Eyre and Aftergut stressed that Attorney General Merrick Garland has to juggle competing priorities lest he politicizes his department, while being extra careful to ensure any charges he may bring against Donald Trump will stand up in court. Aftergut said, "Merrick Garland's between the rock of defending one Justice Department ideal and the hard place of protecting another. On the one hand, no person is above the law. On the other hand, the department needs to avoid, as much as possible, consistent with the first ideal, appearing political." Aftergut said, "There's nothing easy about the position of Merrick Garland is in. The safest course before considering the prosecution of a former president would be to demand considerably more evidence of guilt than you'd require in any other case." Donald Eyre added, "Merrick Garland is right not to be discussing the specifics of whether and how Donald Trump may be indicted, a stance Garland has adopted to protect the Department of Justice's credibility as not political." At the same time, Donald Eyre suggested that Merrick Garland should spend more time talking to the country about impartial justice and the idea that no person is above the law. there are clear risks in moving too fast to appease critics. The former federal prosecutor, Michael Zeldin, said Merrick Garland must make his decisions based on the law in relation to the facts. The more politicians endeavor to pressure Garland to act, it runs the risk that any decision Garland makes will be seen as politically motivated rather than based on purely legal considerations. That seems to fit with Merrick Garland's approach. In his 5th of January speech this year, Garland emphasized, "We follow the physical evidence, we follow the digital evidence, we follow the money. But most important of all, we follow the facts, not an agenda or an assumption. The facts tell us where to go next. And if there is enough evidence, following the rules could end up with Donald Trump getting charged."
Food for thought.
Salam, friends, and here is some food for thought in this blessed month of Ramadan for stimulating our minds. Once Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, heard a woman who was fasting swear at a maidservant. He ordered food to be brought and told her to eat. She said, "I am fasting, O Messenger of Allah." He said, "What kind of fast is it when you swear at your servant?" Fasting is not just refraining from food and drink. Indeed, God Almighty has made the fast a restraint from all ugly conduct and evil speech, which can invalidate the fast. How few are those who really keep their fast, and how many are those who just remain hungry?
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi,
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio. And you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi al-salam. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, when he wrote a letter to his commander Malik al-Ashtar, as he sent him as a governor to Egypt, he gave him a list of instructions. And these instructions Malik had to apply in order to preserve the rights of people. So it is the human rights of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, the charter of human rights of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, is the most comprehensive charter of human rights that we have today. Now, Amir al-Mu'mineen gave him many, many instructions. But there's one that he left for last, the most important one of them all, which is pretty much the core of all these rights. In order for a person to apply human rights and make sure that the rights of others are maintained and preserved, first he has to make sure that he is fit for the task. In the sense, he needs to fight himself. He needs to make sure that he is in the right position. So Amir al-Mu'mineen says to him, shun self-adoration and do not indulge in self-praise. Now, that's a massive issue, especially with those who are in power. So with power, not only comes a great responsibility, as it is stated in Spider-Man, but with power comes danger, comes self-conceit, self-pride, self-ego, and all that. Because when you are in power and people look at you as an authority figure, then you feel that you are God, like Fir'aun said, أَنَا رَبُّكُمُ الْأَعْلَىٰ, I am your Lord. It leads a person to think like that. So the Amir al-Mu'mineen says to him, maintaining human rights, preserving human rights, giving people their rights, has to begin from the fact that you are fit for the job. And to first to begin with cleansing yourself from self-praise and self-indulgence. And he says, nor encourage others to exalt you, and nor encourage others to extol you. Because sometimes you might not have a self-praise issue, but people do. And people usually, they love that. They love to, you know, speak highly of other people, trying to seek their attention or their approval or even their wealth, right? So we have that even today, where people, as we say, they are sucking up to someone else. And this is something that's not Islamically frowned upon. Even Amir al-Mu'mineen, one day he was walking and a person got up, or people got up, and then he said to them, why? They said to him, well, you know, something that we do to respect our elders. He says, you know what? Sit down. Nor will you benefit, nor am I going to increase. So this is just a bad action. It's not required. So sometimes people do that. And the more people do it and we don't say anything about it, it will get in our heads. It will make me feel and think that, yeah, maybe I am like that. So he's saying to him, don't do it yourself. And make sure you don't let people do it to you. Otherwise, you will become self-centered. And in return, people's right will be taken away from them. Let us take a short break, and then we will continue right after.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at English Radio at irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Also, in terms of trying to maintain and apply human rights, there are things are required for a person to have to be in that position. So Amir al-Mu'mineen says to Malik in that letter, do not make haste to do a thing before its time, which is very important. Sometimes that the state or the government or the people in authority, they have plans to do things. But sometimes what happens is that they try to initiate and work their plans before either their due time or due course or before revenue and money is available. And then when they start doing it and it becomes premature because they have not thought it clearly, it falls out and then you have infrastructure and you have things are half done. And I sometimes walk in the streets and I can see that with my own eyes. So I'm saying to him, in order to maintain the rights of people, you yourself, don't be too hasty, don't be too quick to make things that have not, it's not time for them yet. Keep that in mind. Not put it off when the right moment arrives. Sometimes vice versa. It is the appropriate time to give people something that they require the most. For example, infrastructure. For example, transport. It is the right time to give it to them. That's when people need it the most. But you see that the governments, for example, don't do it. They just don't care. Then they end up depriving people of their rights. So in terms of not doing it before it's time and not delaying it, one needs to have that self-control and that self-equilibrium, to say the least. Then he says to him, do not insist on doing a wrong thing, which is also a basic human right, especially when we talk about the masses, when we talk about the subjects and citizens of a country or a system, where sometimes those who are in power, they do something wrong that deprive people of their rights. But yet, governments insist on doing the same thing. Even they can see that people are being harmed, people are suffering because of it, they keep doing it. Nor show slackness in rectifying a wrong thing. Sometimes you know it's wrong. The governments can see that this is wrong. This is taking the rights of people. Why not fix it? They can see that raising prices, or when the prices rise, people start to suffer, especially the poor class. They suffer the most. They can see that. It could be fixed. It could be easily fixed. But yet, they refuse to do so. So he says, don't slack in that case. Make sure you do it. Perform everything at its proper time and let everything occupy its proper place. So time and place makes huge difference in trying to maintain the rights of people. So those are specific traits that a person needs to have in order, not just from a moral perspective. So we're not talking about morally here. We're talking about the fact that it needs to be done, and the person needs to have them in order to make sure that the human rights are applied and preserved. Without these traits within a person, then the rights of people will be taken away. We leave it up to here. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله. Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
The first all-private space crew has successfully docked at International Space Station after spending over 20 hours en route. Three paying customers and a former NASA astronaut will spend 10 days aboard the ISS. The tourist will participate in scientific research, including stem cell experiments and exploring how the body ages in space. The civilian crew were launched into space in a SpaceX rocket from the Kennedy Space Center on Friday. The trip was brokered by Axiom Space, which is the U.S.-based startup that coordinates rocket rides and provides necessary training. It's not the first time paying customers have visited the ISS. Russia sold seats on a Soyuz spacecraft last year. But this is the first mission that includes a crew entirely comprised of civilians.
A restaurant in the Indonesian capital of Jakarta is taking fine dining to new heights, literally and figuratively, by giving diners a one-of-a-kind experience 50 meters above ground. The restaurant is called Lounge in the Sky. Diners are securely strapped into seats fixed to a table and are hoisted into the air using a heavy-duty lift. First, the gourmet meals are prepared in the main kitchen. Then, the food is loaded onto the platform where the dishes are plated and served to the patrons. The suspended guests are able to take advantage of breathtaking views as they gently rotate at great heights.
At first, it was not easy. I was nervous that I wouldn't be able to swallow the food, let alone drink. But after some time, I could eventually eat. It was thrilling.
While enjoying the meals, the guests use seat belts and the accompanying staff are equipped with safety harnesses. The guests are also briefed on safety regulations before the platform is raised. Diners call the one-hour experience exhilarating and worth the high price. The project developers say the restaurant was aimed at reviving local and international tourism sector after a big slump during the COVID-19 pandemic. The culinary experience is a first in Indonesia and the third in the world after Belgium and Malaysia. A new selfie museum in Sweden is flipping the script by making visitors both the artist and the exhibit. The establishment is dubbed the Museum and is in a shopping mall in Stockholm. Unlike other selfie museums, this one has no works of art on its walls. Instead, its brightly decorated rooms are meant to serve as fun backgrounds for visitors to take their selfies or shoot videos in. Other rooms let the visitors bury themselves in candy-colored foam bricks, strike a pose under neon lights, or sit on a huge, colorful swing. The manager says the museum is interactive and lets the visitors be the artists themselves in order to create the art they want to see. The Drone Show Korea 2022 has been held at the Busan Exhibition and Convention Center, BEXCO. It featured 137 companies and 533 booths, making this year's incarnation the largest in the show's six-year history. The event also featured the participation of a large international industry representatives from Japan and Western Europe. A highlight of this year's event was military technology centered around the unveiling of new indigenous UAVs. This year's show marks a long-endurance liquid hydrogen drone produced by a South Korean company. These developments reflect South Korea's attempt to improve resilience and revolutionize its approach to warfare. The event puts on display the importance of drone industry in various spheres, including defense purposes. More than 163 wildlife species have been released back into lagoons and forests in Colombia's Casanare province after being seized and rehabilitated by authorities fighting wildlife trafficking. These include 15 different species such as anteaters, turtles, macaws, a toucan, and a leopard. They were nurtured back to health by fauna vets from an environmental authority in charge of managing sustainable development. The authority, Corporinoquia, released more than 1,200 animals back into the wild in 2021 alone. Colombia is one of the world's most biodiverse countries by square kilometer and is home to some 10% of the world's flora and fauna.
A super rare bird has added a cute member to critically endangered Sumatran rhinos of Indonesia. The newborn calf is the sixth born since intensive efforts to breed the species began in the 1980s. The female calf, which doesn't have a name yet, was given birth to by a rhino named Rosa in a sanctuary. Rosa has suffered 8 miscarriages since 2005 when she was brought in from the wild for a breeding program. Fewer than 80 Sumatran rhinos remain in the world, mainly on the Indonesian islands of Sumatra and Borneo. Excessive poaching along with other threats has brought the species to the brink of extinction.
With neon lights on the floor and walls, pulsing electronic beats, and a glowing red shuttlecock bouncing back and forth, Malaysian badminton court evokes a sci-fi movie set. Shuttle in the Dark is a badminton hall in the iconic Petronas Twin Towers in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. It was set up in late 2021 by a sport management company to encourage people to take up the racket sport after 2 years of social restrictions because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Director of INEC Sport Management says the initial goal was to draw sports fans and players back into action.
Our initial goal was how can we encourage and gain back the interest of people to come back and play. And not only those enthusiasts, but then as well the new people who was not able to or never play badminton before. So that's why we come out with this experience called Shuttle in the Dark.
Playing on a futuristic court presents an unusual challenge for athletes as they have to adjust their eyes to the darkness to fly. Badminton is one of the most popular sports in Malaysia and Asia, with a thriving community in the Southeast Asian community. It has produced some of the world's top-ranked players.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A zoo in Ireland's capital, Dublin, has unveiled its newest habitat called the Himalayan Hills, a brand new home of the red panda and the snow leopard. Visitors are able to see the red panda's habitat by traveling along the new trail around a rocky edge to an open viewing area. The red pandas are typically climbing, exploring, or munching on bamboo at the top of broad-leafed evergreen trees. The expanded habitat was designed with a red panda's tree-dwelling lifestyle in mind. Also, visitors can gaze up at the 15-meter rocky slope through an impressive panoramic viewing area to spot the snow leopards. These elusive felines are typically nocturnal, so catching a glimpse of one is a rare treat.
Yeah, the animals are settling in well. We've tried to recreate the wild habitat in the Himalayan hills. Both species live quite high up, in case of the snow leopards, up to 5,000 meters on these very steep rocky slopes, which you can see here in the habitat as well. We've tried to use the topology of Dublin Zoo.
The project took a few years to complete. It was halted in 2020 due to the COVID-19 pandemic and massive budget shortages, but was restarted after government funding in 2021. The zoo is part of a protection project for red pandas and snow leopards. These animals are listed as vulnerable due to threats from poaching and severe habitat loss. Ancient Pompeii has a new guardian, Spot, a four-legged robot dog that will inspect the ancient Italian city's streets and tunnels to identify structural issues. The robot, designed by the U.S. firm Boston Dynamics, will patrol Pompeii at nighttime. The robot inspects the smallest of spaces and gathers data for planning interventions to fix safety and structural issues. Equipped with a 360-degree camera, Spot will also protect the city's streets from illegal relic hunters who cause structural damage to the ruins by digging tunnels. Pompeii will also have its own eye in the sky, a Leica BLK-2 flying laser scanner capable of autonomously conducting 3D scans of the ruins, helping Spot carry out its tasks. Safeguarding ancient sites from treasure hunters has always been a problem for every country, especially the ancient ones.
The cherry blossom or sakura season in the Japanese capital is a magical experience as trees burst into bloom, dousing the streets with stunning shades of pink. This year, people are enjoying the occasion to the fullest as COVID restrictions are no more there. Thousands gathered in central Tokyo wearing masks, taking pictures and posing for selfies among the trees. Cherry flowers reach full bloom on Sunday, 4 days earlier than usual, according to the Japan Meteorological Agency. The age-old tradition of viewing cherry blossoms typically takes place across the country. The flowers are a national obsession. People flock to parks to hold parties and picnics. However, due to the pandemic, authorities have asked people to refrain from eating and drinking outdoors.
An ancient place in Guatemala with special significance for the Mayan culture could be the next entry on the World Heritage List. The historic village known today as the Takalik Abaj Archaeological Park was occupied for 1,700 years before it was abandoned and discovered in 1888. It's said to have been home to a pre-Hispanic people. Archaeologists found their way to this mysterious piece of land where they found a series of exotic artifacts and sculptures back in 2008. Guatemala's Minister of Cultural Heritage says this site has a sacred place in the nation's culture.
Takalik Abaj is a sacred place with important links to Guatemala's culture. It's a place that harbors flora and fauna biodiversity and even Mayan spirituality and war is wild. This makes this place highly important within the Mayan culture in Guatemala.
Archaeologists believe the monuments go back to the deep-rooted civilizations of Olmec and Maya in a Central American culture around 400 BC. The government has presented the site to UNESCO, hoping it will be declared a World Heritage Site. A Belgian-British teenager is on a solo flight around the globe that could make him a world record holder. Mark Rutherford started his journey from a small airfield near the Bulgarian capital Sofia on Wednesday. His first destination is the island of Sicily in Italy. From there, he'll fly south to Africa and then around the globe to cross the finish line again in Bulgaria. The 16-year-old pilot says he got his inspiration from his sister.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.